you, Dean, for inviting myself and David Neuberger to introduce this series, In Power. I think one of the interesting themes which will emerge this evening and on later evenings will be, is the word power right? Do people actually sense power? One of the attractions for me of being involved in here, because one of the things I learnt at the Institute for Government, which is the other side of the park, another space and geography which is quite interesting in its way, is that government really exists to improve the effectiveness of government. But when I look at government, what strikes me, and I look at this audience this evening, representatives of the judiciary very strongly, civil service, other public services, clergy, House of Lords, all represented here, is how, whilst they're all here, you're all here tonight, but actually you often inhabit different silos. One of the things that strikes me most strongly about British public life is how people don't belong just to one establishment, which is a frequent accusation made, but several establishments often, several different power structures. And often they don't talk to each other very much. And one of the things I try to do at the Institute for Government is bring people together in a rather different way from the way you're doing here tonight. But with the parallels in a way, because often the language talked is very different. Between the judiciary, the executive, politicians, the clergy, react and behave in different ways. Now, this wasn't always so. In fact, here we are in this beautiful chapel of Henry VII. Henry VII wouldn't have recognised in any respect at all distinctions, particularly between clergy, lawyers. He wouldn't have had much time for the commons, certainly, and not always for the lords. He would regard them as all merged together. Indeed, if we go back, 150 years, the judiciary was sitting in Westminster Hall. It must have always, I feel, rather noisy there, with all the courts meeting there. And even in David Neuberger's own period, when he was a law lord, a member of the Appellate Committee of the House of Lords, he sat in a committee room in the House of Lords, the red benches there. It is less than a decade since the legislation was passed to create the Supreme Court on one side of Parliament Square. It's comparatively recent. Whilst constitutionally there may have been distinctions, the physical proximity was very strong. And indeed, not that long ago, some people in the exact position of some of the now members of the Supreme Court sitting in the audience this evening, memorably would have rulings upstairs in the committee room in the Lords in the morning, and in the afternoon speak on and move amendments against the government of the day. That memorably happened. And so a lot of the contradictions of what the legal system was about surfaced there. Now, I'm delighted that David Neuberger is here. His own career as an extremely distinguished judge. He, as I said, was a member of the Appellate Committee when it was sitting over the road that side rather than over there. Then became Master of the Rolls, and then for over 3 years has been President of the Supreme Court. He's always been interested in the wider aspects of the judiciary, diversity, and its relationship to the wider citizenship. And those are amongst the concepts I want to explore in a preliminary way with him before we open it up to questioning for you. So, David, could I start with the concept of justice? When you go into the Supreme Court building, you're struck by the grand statements, grand signals of justice, the pinnacle of the judicial system. But is it quite like that? I'm not quite big Dickensian and evoking the spirit of Bleak House and the fog and everything like that. But in a different way, it can appear quite remote from ordinary people.
I think that traditionally, it has been seen as important that the law is somewhat remote, somewhat detached, somewhat to be feared almost. That's partly because justice has always to be detached, almost Olympian. Judges famously take an oath to dispense justice without fear, favour, affection, or ill will, which all are human features, emotions which we have to forswear. It's partly also to make people respect the law. It's also partly with the idea of making people less likely to be dishonest when they give evidence, to tell the truth, and to behave properly in the face of the court. I think those are all still relevant functions and features, But I think that in the 21st century, we are more conscious of the need to make people, ensure that people understand what is going on in court, both in terms of the general public and in terms of individual litigants and witnesses understanding what is going on. And I think over the past few decades, we have attempted to take the law to the non-lawyers, explain to them what's going on, in individual cases, explain to witnesses, to parties what is going on, try to take away much of the Latin, much of the technical expressions. And so far as the public's concerned, to let them try to explain to them what we are doing and why. I mean, in the Supreme Court, for example, we've taken advantage of our relatively new creation to film what's going on so you can watch us streamed, to give our judgments actually being filmed and summarizing our judgments in relatively simple form so that journalists can quickly understand them rather than having to read 100 pages sometimes of our judgments. We are open to the public in a much more easy access way than we were in the House of Lords. And all those features, I think, are important. It's easier for the Supreme Court than for most other courts. We don't have witnesses, so we don't have to worry about witnesses, let alone juries, being intimidated or nervous because they're being filmed. We don't have to worry about people losing their way and not knowing where they are. We've got relatively few courts. And we are relatively prominent and easy to find.
But there is a sense, isn't there, of a caste apart. In the sense, I mean, the priesthoods are caste apart, politicians are often now caste apart, and therefore you appear different. I mean, you know, in the obvious sense that the senior judiciary is still dominated by men of a certain background.
Yes. First of all, there is a necessary element of detachment. You talked earlier about, as it were, the silo mentality. You've got the judiciary, you've got the executive, you've got the legislature. And I remember when I was in the House of Lords, sitting there, members of the House of Commons, who were then ceased being MPs and became peers, said how little they knew about the House of Lords till they got there. We are there's less intercommunication than there should be. I think that the judges have to be detached to some extent. We can't express views about a number of issues in public because that's not our function. We have to be detached because as judges we have to decide cases without any appearance of bias and without any actual bias. The other matter you mentioned is diversity. And there the judiciary in the past, 50 years ago or less, there were no women senior judges at all, no non-white judges at all among the senior judiciary. Things have got better over the past 50 years, but particularly among the senior judiciary, we have some way to go. And I think it's particularly important among the judiciary that we become more diverse. A, inevitably, if you choose from a narrower pool, you are going to get fewer excellent people because you're giving up the opportunity of getting some of the best people, which is worse than unfortunate for the judiciary. Secondly, for a profession primarily concerned with justice, it's plainly unfair that we should be overrepresented in one group or several groups. Thirdly, there is a risk of the public losing confidence in a judiciary which is not representative and fair. And fourthly, judges deciding cases mean that it's important for them to have brought to the table as many different views as possible, as many different experiences as possible, and that is only achievable if you have a properly diverse judiciary.
Another aspect where people think the law is remote, I mean, the kind of cliche is, in civil cases, no one, you know, ordinary person would want to bring a case because of the cost of it, the time involved of it, and that there's a curious sense, you know, when I go down to the Strand, you've got this wonderful new bill or
the
Wells Building, which is, you know, heavily populated by oligarchs suing each other. Now, it's an interesting aspect of the law. I mean, it's one of our great exports, the legal. I mean, in a sense, it's a badge of honour for Britain that people want to bring their legal cases here because they respect British justice, they respect British lawyers, they want to have their commercial cases done here. But if it's, and this clearly brings a lot of money to Britain and employs a lot of people, but if it's then inaccessible to ordinary Britons because of cost and so on, is justice being done?
When one says there are two legal professions, people normally think you mean barristers and solicitors. But in a way, there are two legal professions in a different sense, which is more worrying. Those who serve the large organisations, rich individuals, government departments, and so on, who are well paid, sometimes very well paid, and who have clients for whom costs are not normally the primary concern. They perform not only a very important function for themselves, they earn a very nice living, but they perform a very important part for society, particularly in this country, where we are so dependent on in what used to be called invisible earnings, now I think called the service industries. And as the Lord Mayor of London has made clear recently on more than one occasion, the legal profession in this country provides a very important role in that, and it's therefore important for the economy. That is fine, that side of our legal world. Where there are bigger problems, and it's inherent in the system that there are bigger problems, it's easy to complain, is, as you say, for the ordinary person. Legal aid was available for a large number of people until about 1999. And then, from then on, it has become harder and less available. And this has meant that it has been more difficult for people to litigate. And I think this is worrying if it gets worse, because there is nothing worse than giving people rights, whether they're human rights or rights against your neighbour or rights against your spouse or rights against somebody who knocks you over, if you can't actually enforce those rights by going to court. Similarly, if you are sued by somebody rich, you have to have the opportunity to defend yourself. Now, lawyers are very good at blaming the government and saying that they have to provide more money. And one appreciates that there are problems for a government at the moment, and for the past few years, there's been limited money. But I think the lawyers and judges have a duty too. We have to make litigation, the cost of litigation, the time you also rightly refer to, proportionate. If somebody has a claim for £20,000, it is ridiculous that we have a system where it would cost that person and his or her opponent each £150,000 to fight over it. Have to make it, if we possibly can, proportionate. Again, easy to say, not so easy to do.
But isn't that an argument for almost a kind of parallel system, mediation, arbitration coming in much more, where the costs can be less and the time can be less too? I know there's a distinction between arbitration and mediation, which is quite important.
Yes, arbitration is basically private litigation, and I don't think it actually saves much money. In a way, you have to pay your arbitrator, you have to pay for your room, etc. It may cost more. But you're quite right about mediation. The mediation, if it works, and mediation involves, really, the two sides getting together informally with a third party, a mediator, trying to encourage them and shepherd them into getting a settlement. It's terrific if it works, because it is quicker and cheaper and, importantly, as importantly, much less stressful. It gets the solution to the case out of the way in a relatively amicable way. But, of course, you can't make people settle. And if the mediation doesn't work, it's added to the cost, added to the time, and probably added to the bad feeling. Such figures as I've seen suggest that in most cases where it's tried, mediation works. And I think the general perception is that in the great majority of cases, big and small, mediation should be encouraged.
Now, looking at the underpinning of law, particularly where we are in the Abbey, it's always been underpinned historically by religion in various ways. And indeed, in many countries with different faiths, it's still a very strong underpinning there. Historically, many of the great disputes were indeed with the church and the state coming involved in that. So how do you see the interlinking between religion and the law, David?
Well, I think, as you say, in the past, they were very closely linked together indeed. And even in the 1820s, I think the Chief Justice of the time said that Christianity was part of the law of the land. But by 1917, I think it was, a law lord said that was rhetoric. And I think many people nowadays would say that religion and law were unrelated. I personally think the position is more nuanced than that. In the end, both religion and law are trying to achieve justice, fairness, morality, and they're both based ultimately on what we think is right. Religion does things occasionally which aren't right. The law produces results in individual cases that aren't right, in most people's eyes, morally. But the basic rule, for instance, if you think about it, in court, witnesses are expected to tell the truth. If you like, that's moral. The law of contract is that people should keep their word. That's moral. And if we dig a little deeper, the Old and New Testament, exemplified by the sermon at the beginning of the legal year 2 weeks ago, was the story of the Good Samaritan with the Old and New Testament injunction, love your neighbor as yourself. The law, with its slightly less emotional, more dry view of life, transposes that into saying you should not do actions or refrain from doing actions which may reasonably be expected to harm your neighbour. A little bit more of a mouthful, a little bit less engaging, but that again shows the similarity between the two. So I think there are similarities and they can learn from each other, but they are a good deal more far apart than they were perceived to be four or five hundred years ago.
And if you look at Magna Carta, we now regard them as parts of Magna Carta which are of no particular application, but they had actually direct linkages with religion at the time and issues like usury and so on.
Oh, yes. It's certainly true, but as you say, the overlap between lawyers and the church, the overlap between, after all, our courts are called courts because originally we were the king's judges or the queen's judges, and we operated in the king's court. The idea of separation of powers was unknown, and at least that had the advantage, I suppose, of not having the silos in which we all now work, as you describe.
Yes, indeed, some of the conflict of Thomas of Becket was exactly as a conflict of jurisdiction. We won't pursue that at the moment. Looking at the title, In Power, what is the role of the judges? In a sense, one of the classic arguments which has swirled round the judiciary for 20 years at least, is between making and interpreting the law. The charge is judicial activism, that you're making the law, you're not just interpreting it any longer. And that balance has changed.
I think it's always been the case that judges have made the law to some extent. But the basic truth is that if Parliament legislates for something in a statute, it's not open to the judges, as it were, to make law inconsistent with that. We have to apply statutes. We have a system in this country where Parliament, although we have the three branches of government, Parliament, the executive, and the judiciary, what Parliament says ultimately goes. So, perhaps slightly defensively, I'd say that although it's true that the judges have become more, if you like, proactive over the past 20 years for various reasons, more proactive probably over the past 50 years, but particularly the past 20. The fact remains that if we do something that Parliament doesn't like, if we make a decision Parliament doesn't like, Parliament can overrule us. So the idea of the unelected judges overruling or contradicting the elected people in the House of Commons is false, because even if we decide something that a statute means what Parliament didn't intend it to mean, which does happen, then Parliament can change the statute.
But, before coming on to two caveats, what about the areas where Parliament hasn't taken a view? Because one of the interesting things is during the 70s, Parliament took a view on some of the really big moral issues. Homosexuality, abortion, change the divorce law. There were some very fundamental changes in that, which actually, in a sense, made it less hard, if I put it that way, for the courts, because you say statute was clear. It is no longer necessarily true. I mean, the classic issue now on that is assisted dying, where the House of Commons recently rejected any change in the law. Now, you've already had cases come up to cases on that, and it's quite likely they will recur, putting you in a position of challenge where Parliament has declined to take a view.
Probably the biggest factor, or one of the bigger factors in increasing judicial power, or at least perceived judicial power, has been the Human Rights Act. The Suicide Act 1961 says that assisting a suicide in any circumstances is a crime. Now, if that's what statute says, even if you passionately believe it's wrong as a judge, you have to accept that that's the law. However, under the Human Rights Act, Parliament has decided that the judges can say that a particular statute conflicts with human rights in some way or another. The issue we had in the assisted suicide case was whether the Suicide Act, in prohibiting in all circumstances assisting a suicide, conflicted with the rights of people who were incapable of killing themselves, but because they were completely paralyzed and felt their lives were useless, wanted to be assisted to die. Now, we couldn't say helping them was legal, because Parliament had said in the Suicide Act it was illegal. What we could have said, and what two of the nine of us did think, was that the Act conflicted with the Human Rights Convention, of the human rights of those people who wanted to kill themselves or be assisted to die. Now, if we had decided, we didn't, but if we had decided that the Suicide Act did conflict with human rights, it would still have been open to Parliament under our systems to say, thank you very much, judges, that's what you think, but we're not going to do anything about it. Up to now, save in relation to prisoners' votes, Parliament has always taken on board what we've said when we've said we think a particular statute conflicts in some way with human rights and has amended the law. But under our system, Parliament has the last word, and it's up to Parliament what happens. Picking up the other point, it does mean the Human Rights Act and the way that administrative law has moved, that is, domestic judges considering under domestic law how local authorities, ministers, and other branches of government have carried out their functions. It is right to say that we have become, if you like, more political. It may be a good thing, it may be a bad thing, but it's what's happened. But as I say, the safety valve in our democratic system is Parliament has the last word.
With important caveat, of course, Europe. The European, I don't mean Strasbourg Court, what I mean is the European Union, because once we accepted entry, we accepted, under the accession treaty, the superiority of European law.
That is true, but the judges in this country only accept that European law trumps Parliament because Parliament has said so in a statute, the European Communities Act. If Parliament repealed the European Communities Act, then we would no longer be able to trump Parliament through the European Union. It always comes back to Parliament's decision.
That point on getting more involved in political decisions also covers a couple of other points, which is the balance between the citizen and the state. That particularly if you have long periods of one party in government, and indeed if you look at the growth of judicial review, a lot of it did coincide with a long period of conservative rule between 79 and 97, also possibly with a new generation of judges, of which you were one of the younger generation at that stage. Coming up then, and therefore there is a response almost to political circumstances that way. People look to the courts if there is a long period when one party's in power.
I think that's right. I mean, I suppose it's oversimple, but the courts have three important functions. One is the one everybody knows about, which is to ensure that people accused of crimes are properly tried and fairly tried and dealt with according to the law. The second is to resolve disputes between individuals, whether neighbours, whether married couples, or as it were, private rights. And the third, which you're focusing on, which is very important, is to protect the citizen against the state and ensure that when a citizen feels that his or her rights have been infringed in some way by the state, a minister or a local authority or some other organisation harming them, normally, of course, unintentionally, but nonetheless harming them in a way or harming their interests in a way which is unlawful, they have to have the opportunity to come to court, and the function of the judge is to say, yes, your rights are being infringed, or no, they're not. But that is the third important function of the courts.
And that also, in the era of mass terrorism, produces other conflicts for the judiciary too. Very important ones are between defending individuals, which the state wishes to do, and human rights.
Yes,
in ways which before mass terrorism wouldn't have occurred as issues.
That is perfectly true. I think legal problems often involve balancing two competing interests or two competing arguments. Sometimes the arguments relate to each other, but very often they're ships, as it were, that pass in the night. And the threat from international terrorism on the one hand and personal liberty from the state on the other hand have nothing much in common. They're both very, very important, and balancing them for a judge, indeed for anybody, is remarkably difficult. It's one of those areas which, coming back to what you said, makes it particularly important for us to ensure that although we have to be independent, that we do have some degree of contact with the lawmakers, with the executive, with the secret services even, so we understand what's going on.
But that's very difficult to achieve.
Well, one has to do it in a way which preserves our and their independence. But at least we have to understand each other.
Now, of course, one interesting thing, in a classically British way, and I know the chairman of the Judicial Appointments Commission is here this evening, when you were set up as part of the big act, which went through lots of excitements in the House of Lords between 2003 and 2005, not only set up the Supreme Court, changed the role of the Speaker in the Lords, but also set up the Judicial Appointments Commission. We have now a machinery which is more independent, not totally independent, more independent of ministers in appointing judges. That's a real contrast to what happens in other systems. I remember vividly when I worked in the United States, being in Austin, Texas, where they elect their judges to the state Supreme Court. I went to a fundraiser for an equivalent at the state level, and Texas is a big state, of you and your colleagues, and they were raising money from the tort lawyers who were appearing before them earlier that day and the next day. Now, I'm certainly not advocating that, but inevitably there are going to be questions about judicial appointments, aren't there, as you get more involved in the political process.
Yes, I think that's true. I wouldn't favour for a moment the American US Supreme Court system of potential judges of the Supreme Court, for instance, being called before a parliamentary committee to be approved. I think that would be destructive, and watching what goes on in the United States is not a great advertisement for it. But it's certainly true that the old system of the Lord Chancellor, albeit we had some very good Lord Chancellors in recent times who took enormous care over appointments, but it was not... wouldn't have had the public confidence which an organisation like the Judicial Appointments Commission has, consisting of some judges, some lawyers, but a majority of lay people who can be much more open both as to what they're doing and as to how they do it. And I think that although it means that we have a more expensive system and it can take longer, and it is not so comfortable for judges who want promotion or lawyers who want to become judges or others who want to become judges, they have to go through a more formal system than before. I think that it's not merely a good thing, it's an inevitable thing.
One thing you touched on there, David, was the it's more formal, but that's true of quite a lot of other aspects of British public life now. If you go back to when you trained as a lawyer, I mean, you were a scientist originally, but when you trained as a lawyer, there was much more informality about the working of British public life, in the classic sense, and no doubt it'll surface in some of the later dialogues, of good chaps know best view of things. Now, British public life is increasingly codified and statutory. Now, all right, we don't have a written constitution in the sense that Germany has, the United States has, and all but about three or four countries in the world do have, but we do have an increasingly statutes which have a constitutional bearing. Now, surely that changes the role of your court and the judiciary as a whole. You're being dragged in much more to some quite big constitutional questions because there are now statutes. I mean, it's already happening on devolution.
Yes, I think the most obvious constitutional function we have is in relation to devolution. If there's an argument about whether the Scottish Parliament or the Welsh Assembly or the Northern Irish Assembly has the right to do something or power to do something, we decide as a Supreme Court. The Human Rights Convention could be said to be something like a constitution, but the truth is that we don't really have what I regard as a constitution, which at the very least is a coherent document in great detail in the case of places like Germany, in much less detail in a place like the United States, which basically purports to set out the basis on which the country is run, and normally, which can't just be reversed by a simple majority in Parliament. We have nothing like that at all. People like to think that the Magna Carta or the Bill of Rights of 1688 is a constitutional document. But almost all Magna Carta, 58 of its 61 clauses, have simply been repealed by Parliament. To be fair, many of them have been reenacted in fresh statutes, but it is just no different in practice from a statute. And to that extent, together with, I think, Israel and New Zealand, we are one of the very, very few countries that don't have a constitution. There's a debate in many quarters between those who think we should have one and those who think we shouldn't. And it's quite a difficult debate because we have managed as a country pretty well without one for a long time. But as our system gets more and more complicated and there are more complaints about different aspects of it and uncertainties, there's an argument for at least investigating quite carefully whether we should have a constitution. But personally, I would be very cautious before having one.
But in practice, your court is becoming more of a constitutional court, even if it isn't in the sense of the US Supreme Court. Or the German model is quite interesting, because that doesn't have some of the unfavorable connotations you described with the US one. I mean, I experienced it working in the States when you saw the nomination hearings, which became intensely politicized, and they became a massive political battle, which avoid that in Germany. But in practice, you may be pulled in that direction. As we have more devolution legislation, I mean, there's bills going through Parliament now, with substantial effect. And that is likely to result in more cases which go up through the appeals court and to the Supreme Court. So de facto, you may become more like that.
Yes, I mean, the British system seems to involve sleepwalking almost into a situation by a change here and a change there caused by what seemed a good idea at the time or by a crisis. It would be quite difficult, I think, for us to develop into a constitutional court like the German or American without a positive decision, because I've been banging on about the fact that we can't overrule Parliament. The US court, Supreme Court, and I think the German Supreme Court can say, sorry, you may have passed this piece of legislation, Parliament, but I'm afraid it's unconstitutional and we're going to quash it. And that really is unelected judges overruling Parliament.
Now, before bringing members of the audience into the dialogue, let me just pose a question to you. Looking at the judicial system as a whole, how robust is it? How confident do you feel, given all the pressures you face, which you've described, David, from the constitutional challenges, the problems of access to the legal system, legal aid, and so on? How robust is it?
I think there are a number of potential problems. I think in terms of public perception, the diverse and reality, the diversity problem is there, but I hope and think it is being solved. Secondly, in England and Wales, the court system is groaning and in danger of falling over, and we need a serious, and being considered, I think, serious rationalisation of the courts and of the way and of the IT, so that it really is fit for the 21st century. Thirdly, specifically with the judiciary, I think that there is a problem at the moment, as a recent survey conducted by UCL, with the assistance of UCL, shows that judicial morale is quite low. That's partly, I think, attributable to the way the system, the courts, the amount of work that's required, which could be, if the court system was made more effective and more efficient, that would solve part of the problem. But frankly, there is a problem about money. Whether you like it or not, many of the best lawyers who one would like to get as judges do practice at the commercial end of the bar, where they make quite a lot of money. And they have always been asked and have always been prepared to take a large cut in pay to become judges. But I think there is a risk now that the recent changes to legislation mean that we could have a serious problem about recruiting good people in the way that we have in the past. It's a difficult story to sell, because by most people's standards, of course, judges are paid very well. But as is often said by government ministers when they want to say it, you have to pay the rate for the job.
Indeed. Yes, that's, it is, indeed. Well, it's been an absolutely fascinating discussion. A lot of reflections I've had on the challenges you and your colleagues face as judges in a very difficult environment with a lot of awkward moral issues, political issues coming up. The challenges also of not being remote. I mean, I just had one thought after Ruth Deitch's question when you mentioned social exclusion. I was thinking of one of your predecessors as Master of the Rolls, who was a chemist's son from Northwest Hampshire and spoke in a Hampshire burr. So it was sometimes possible, but Lord Denning was always an exception to every rule. But I think the interesting thing is, as you say, the challenges with diversity, not just with gender, but also with ethnic minorities and the time it does to achieve that. And the often the sense of when you've made progress, but that actually is the time when people notice it more. Yes. But also in the political environment too, that I think it's going to be a very difficult time for the senior judiciary as we see a period of real constitutional change, of quite big moral issues being fiercely debated. And that's why I wanted to raise the point of social media, because a lot of the established conventions for debate are under challenge, and we've seen that politically in the last few months. And that's why I think this has been an absolutely fascinating way to get this dialogue going. I'm very glad the Westminster Abbey Institute has got a question mark behind in power, because one thing I think is clear, that the senior judiciary is not in power. It has a lot of influence, it has a lot of say in individual cases, but perhaps not power. And indeed, one of the main conclusions perhaps of all this series would be that no one has power, but it's contested between them. So I'd like you to join me in thanking David Neuberger very much for his candour, and I was about to say, not just in candour, no, you don't have to applaud after this, in what is the beginning of an extremely busy week, because the courts are back, over the road is very busy, and indeed, you've got the opportunity, having heard him tonight, to go and see him in action if you wish to do so. So thank you very much indeed, David.
I'd like to thank Peter very much for his performance. If I've said things I shouldn't have said, that's due to his charm. If I haven't said anything I shouldn't have said, then I thank him for encouraging my discretion. And thank you very much for your questions.